I don't know who assigns these speaking topics, but somehow they just pop into your mind. And this was about a month ago, and I've been thinking about it. I said, why on earth would I pick this subject? But then listening to Elbert's message and Les's message recently, I guess it'll sort of fit in. It's one of those subjects that could have a tendency to get very political, so I'll try and avoid that. But there's a lot of wisdom in the Scriptures that we should be thinking about, because in our day and age right now, particularly in the next few months, the next year basically, politics are going to dominate the media. We're going to be hearing a lot of stuff, a lot, for lack of a better word, things that really will rock our senses. I think particularly as the two leading candidates get into each other's proximity, but that's a few months away. How many times in life can you think of situations where you can say, I didn't see that coming? There have been many instances throughout history where there's been developments, world developments, where things came into being where we can truly say, we didn't see that coming. We should have, maybe, if we were on top of our game, if we were paying attention to what's going on, we should be able to say, well, yeah, I kind of saw that. But there's been so many cases. There's this thing called the law of unintended consequences. So many times our government will try and do something to make the situation better. And years down the road, we kind of find out, well, yeah, that worked, but there were so many other related things to it. What we would have to say are unintended consequences of the good intentions. It happens. As the Apostle Paul said in 1 Corinthians 13:12, he says, we see through a glass darkly. Now, he's made that statement in reference to prophetic events in a general sense. The further we are from a development, it seems the less clear it is to us as to exactly how it's going to come out. We do see through a glass darkly. We always have. We can go back and look at the prophecies that we thought were sure 30, 40 years ago. And a lot of them are generally on track, but as the world has developed now, we see the situation in a lot greater reality than we did back then. There's this thing, and we'll find it in the church, and any church for that matter, but there's this situation where we read prophecies, we read the Word, and it appeals to us in sort of a religious sense. But we have to understand, with God's prophecies, there is also a reality. This thing is going to move from a religious connotation to actual reality. And think about how the world is going to react to that, how we're going to react to that. There is a reality to this. And it's that reality that we need to keep in mind, because we are in a special category of people, not because of our individual greatness, but for some reason God has chosen to call us at this time. And I'm getting ahead of the story, but keep this thought in mind as we go through this material. We are going to be given the ability to understand what's going on in a way that even the smartest people in this world aren't going to get. Back in 1929, our grandparents' generation, there was an event that happened that the people in the 1920s thought couldn't possibly happen. It was such a wonderful time. The stock market was soaring. That could never stop. I mean, it was wonderful. People were making all kinds of money. Even the smallest investors were giddy with how their stock choices were growing. A few people saw what was coming, but really very few did. And the economy tanked. The stock market crashed, I might say the first Sabbath after the Feast of Tabernacles. And the stock market crash that happened back in just a few years ago happened to also be the first Sabbath after the Feast of Tabernacles for whatever reason. Just an interesting consequence. But what did that mean? Now, in this country, it meant a real deep depression. Millions of people were thrown out of work, had no income, lost their homes, lost their farms. But there was another consequence to that that we didn't necessarily see at the time. We can see it now in history. But back in the middle 1920s, there was a little individual running around in Germany trying to be elected to high office. His name was Adolf Hitler. He and his party were basically an asterisk. They were their percentage of in the parliament or the government at the time was very minor. Germany was prospering. Why was it prospering? I mean, right after the defeat of World War I, they were in dire straits. Their economy was in the tank. But the people, the bankers in this country and elsewhere around the world, were loaning Germany massive amounts of money. And in doing so, Germany began to prosper. And as long as they prospered, Hitler was really a nobody. But when this country experienced the stock market crash, the bankers here withdrew their loans, and Germany's economy crashed. And it was in that climate where Hitler could rise to power. Had we not had happened here, it could have been a very different world. There were a few people who saw the threat posed by Nazi Germany, but most didn't. Britain, for example, for the most part, dismissed the significance of what was developing. One man in particular, Winston Churchill, saw it for what it was, but he had a hard time selling the idea to anyone else. Mr. Attlee went over there and thought he could negotiate with Hitler and came back thinking the world's going to be fine. They didn't see it coming. And that happens so often in the world, and it happens in our personal lives. We can say, we didn't see that coming. Now, pardon me if this next narrative is a little too political for some people, but I should mention it, because I think it's important. Back when the elder George Bush was running for a second term, another man came on the scene. He livened up the dialogue. He brought up a lot of issues that the typical political structure didn't want to address at the time. A fellow named Ross Perot, do you remember him? Well, he did his thing, and he decided to run as an independent, and he took 19% of the vote, mostly from the Republican side. And as a result, we had the Clinton administration. Okay, so what? Well, Mr. Clinton got himself into some trouble. And unbeknownst to a lot of people, there was a law passed that prohibited one intelligence agency from sharing information with another intelligence agency, if you can imagine that. Then we had, as a result of that, the terrorist attacks on 9/11. Now, it was found that the intelligence agencies had separately certain parts of pieces of information that, had they been put together, they might have caught on to what was developing. But they didn't. And so, what happened, happened. Pretty much undiscovered until it happened. There was a particular individual, and her name is Jamie Gerlich, who was instrumental in getting that law developed and passed. You have to wonder why the government or why Congress would pass such a thing. But the law that made it illegal for one intelligence agency to share information with another. And then after that, after the Clinton administration, she was put in a high position with HUD, making, $250,000 a year, I think. Very, very healthy salary. And then it turns out when the 9/11 commission is formed, she's put on the 9/11 commission. Check her history out. Go online and check, follow this lady's career. But it had an effect. And it in part accounts for the situation we have today. And the people we have today who are prominent in the political sphere. But who would have thought, when Ross Perot was doing his thing, that we would have the ultimate consequence that leaves us in the situation we see ourselves in today? I could say more about that, but I won't mention Sandy Bergler stuffing his pants with documents out of the National Archives. And you have to wonder which documents he was selecting. Most of that we can investigate for ourselves online. I'll just mention that these are all related events. One thing led to another. But we didn't, at the time, see it coming. There are other events that are prophesied, and one is, we can read of in 2 Thessalonians 2:7. We should be aware of this because it is something that is going to affect us all. 2 Thessalonians 2:7, and this is a very difficult verse. We talked about it at Bible study last time, and I think it warrants another study, but I think we can get the general sense of it as poorly as it's translated. 2 Thessalonians 2:7, it says, "For the mystery of iniquity does already work." That tells us there's something going on even now that is going to lead to something further. But the difficult part is where it says, "Only he who now letteth will let until he be taken out of the way." There is some trigger event that is going to open up the way for the end time world developments to take place. We of all people are in a position where we should see it coming when it happens. And I think generally we do understand the sense of this. But it's a verse we need to understand, and there's another one comparable to it in the book of Daniel. I won't go there at this point. But there's something else going on, and perhaps it's related to this verse in Thessalonians. But of course, is the events that we see happening right now that we call world terrorism. It isn't just directed against us. Although I think if you notice, it will probably involve more than most the peoples of Israel, the nations of Israel, the modern nations who have an Israelitish heritage. World terrorism is going to create other events. For one thing, we see happening with what's happened in France and what's happened in the Russian airliner and with the situation in Belgium and so on. And there's more to come, be sure. There's more to come. But what is happening is it's beginning to drive the nations of Europe together in a way that wouldn't ordinarily happen. But this common threat and this insidious threat from people who are already on the inside just waiting to do their thing Europe is beginning to be brought together in a more militaristic and a more involved or co-involved arrangement than we would ever expect. At the moment, Russia is leading the pack. But Russia and France, even the United States, is beginning to get involved in a group effort to deal with this problem. I mean, it is an insidious problem. But at the same time, these terrorists are also drawing the peoples of the Middle East together. A few is beginning to dominate the many. And where that will lead us, we don't know. But the general sense is Europe is beginning to coalesce in a defensive posture against those who are in the Middle East. We should be able to see it coming. And hopefully we will. We know from the Daniel chapter, chapter 11, about the King of the North and the King of the South confrontation. When does this occur? I'll have to admit that up until recently, I thought that that was going to occur within the confines of the 3.5 years of what we call the Great Tribulation. Not that there aren't troubles beforehand, but that specific, focused, concentrated trouble time we understand is going to occur within generally the 3.5 years of the beast power. But when does this King of the North, King of the South confrontation occur? I'm beginning to realize that it could be what's developing right now. In advance of the Great Tribulation, it may be the factor that is going to bring nations together to polarize one against the other. I don't think that's too far out of the bounds of reason. There is a key point that Christ gave us to watch for. But it's going to be well into these developments. It's found in Daniel chapter 11, verse 31. Christ made reference to this. And it's something that should be on our mind because it's going to happen. Now, it's happened in the past. There was an ancient fulfillment of this particular prophecy. But from what Christ said in Matthew there's another place in Luke, I believe, where he said, when you see the abomination of desolation set up in the holy place, you can know something. Chapter 11, verse 31. And arms shall stand on his part, and they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, and shall take away the daily sacrifice, and they shall place the abomination that makes desolate. And go over to chapter 12, verse 11. And from the time that the daily sacrifice shall be taken away and the abomination that makes desolate set up, there shall be 1,290 days. So we have a reference point, a reference in time. The people of God are going to understand the significance of these events. The rest of the world, and for all intents and purposes, aren't going to understand what's happening. But we can know, this is something Jesus Christ himself told us to watch for, and we can know that there is a set span of time from this event until the second coming. Are we seeing the beginning of those polarizations between the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, or the southern coalition, if that's the better word, that's going to lead up to this event? In this country, we have a I'll call it a mindset. And it seems to occur the most among the more intelligent people. But there is a general sense of hatred for God. You can see that in a lot of spheres, particularly academia. God is out of the picture. They have no interest in any evidence that would support the idea that God exists. They provide answers to questions that leave God out of the picture. And from that you can see what their regard would be for Bible prophecy. Just a source for ridicule as far as they're concerned. Understanding, my point is, understanding is not related to intelligence. That's something we need to keep in mind, because I think it offers us hope in a way that it may not. You know, many of us would say, well, I don't understand that. I'm not smart enough to get this or get that. Well, it isn't just intelligence. There's something more involved here, and that's where I want to go with this. If we are going to see it coming, when it comes, there is a particular mindset that we need to have, and there is a particular gift that God gives to His people. The general, the general idea in our society right now is carried under the general nomenclature of political correctness. How much of our society is governed by the desire to be politically correct? Truth, in many cases, is irrelevant. We want to evaluate things that we say and do based on what we think the other party is going to perceive, and based on whether or not we think they're going to be offended. So the thousands are offended, in reality, in order to not offend the few. That's how we do things. We've kind of gotten off-center in that respect, where we judge things based on people's feelings, people's reactions, what we think they'll think of us. Somehow they don't care what we think of them. We tend to evaluate our responses to things based on our core perceptions, we don't evaluate our responses based on our core principles. Rather, we want them to get to accept us. We'll bend over backwards to accommodate them, whoever the them is in your mind. And as a result, we've developed a contempt of our core values. And the underlying factor in that is the hatred of God. You can see many of these people that are interviewed on television, and you want to ask them, when did you discover the fact that you hate God? You wish you could ask that question. You wish the interviewer would ask that question. But it's so obvious to somebody who has a right sense of what's going on in this world. But that's the mindset that's overtaken our people. They call it pragmatism, being realistic. There's no sense of any righteous standards anymore. In fact, those are most contemptible because they might offend someone. Even a simple thing as displaying your own flag. Can't do that. It might offend someone. What? You see, we've lost the sense of who we are. Here, a model nation, unique in the world, who has offered more freedoms and more blessings and more benefits to more people than any nation ever has in the history of the world. And somehow we can't hold that up as a standard to the world. No, we have to diminish it and kowtow to their sensitivities. Is that too political? I don't know. I think it's a generalization. Hopefully it covers both parties, because both parties cave into it. Why can't we be the example to the world that we ought to be instead of trying to accommodate every persuasion that might come our way? Look, they don't have to come here. I mean, some people think they do. But if they're offended by our standards, then, you know, there must be some place in the world that upholds their standards. Why should we accommodate their standards and diminish our own? Look what our standards brought to be in the world today. Look what their standards brought to be. Can we say that, or is that too politically incorrect? Why can't we get the sense of this, of who we are and who we ought to be and what standards we ought to set forth as an example to the rest of the world? Do you think they might notice righteousness, righteous standards? Would they be offended with that? Hopefully not, but boy, you never know. There's something in the nature of our people that has developed in the last, let's say, 40, 50 years. It's got a name, I won't use that name, but in general it calls for doing what feels good. Isaiah 3:12 touches on this. Isaiah 3:12. Familiar verse to many of us. For some reason, we've heard this before. I don't know that you would over in the Protestant churches, but as for my people, children are their oppressors and women rule over them. O my people, they which lead you cause you to err and destroy the way of your paths. Our very culture, our very nature as a nation is being destroyed because we won't hold fast to the way that brought us here in the first place. The way that was founded by our founding fathers, based on righteous principles. As for my people, children are their oppressors. And who are the ones we see campaigning for all of these crazy things? Mostly the younger generation. And women rule over them. Got to be careful how you touch that one. But we have someone prominent in our fellowship who talks about, they're not necessarily women, but he talks about them wearing lace underwear. In other words, they've fallen into this way of thinking based on feelings, and it's this feelings kind of thing that fires this political correctness movement. Now, even though the legislators may not all be females, they've accommodated the way of thinking of the feminine side. I don't say that's wrong. In the right situation, the feminine perspective has merits. But when it begins to compromise a whole nation, like this verse says, when it causes us to err, when it causes us to destroy the way that brought us to the situation that we are in today, we need to see the end from the beginning. Do we see it coming? Hopefully we can say yes, but does the nation itself see it coming? I kind of doubt it. We need to not worry about offending people. If we uphold righteous standards, we can have the confidence that we're doing the right thing. Being a light to the nations, exhibiting righteous principles. Don't hide them. Don't denigrate them. The only people you can insult in this country anymore is Christians. Don't try that with any other political or religious group. But Christians, you know, they're fair game anymore. You've noticed that. And it'll increase, I'm sure. God says that there's a particular class of people who are going to understand. He says the wise, in the end time, the wise are going to understand. Now let's understand something about the wise. That's not talking about people who are super intelligent. Wisdom and intelligence are two different things. Let's look at Psalm 111, verse 10. Psalm 111, a simple statement. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. A good understanding have all they that do His commandments. His praise endures forever. The beginning of wisdom comes from the fear of the Lord. That's not the full, its fullest development necessarily, but it's where it begins. Has nothing to do with intelligence. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Let's go over to Proverbs 9:10. Confirms the same. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the holy is understanding. Fear, proper respect for the Lord is where wisdom is founded. And knowledge provides understanding. If God's people don't have that, who does? It's something we need to be aware of. We need to be among those people that God calls the wise. Matthew 24:38. We're kind of reminded of this. Matthew 24:38. Very insightful passage. This is referring to ancient times, those times that led up to the destruction of the world that then was. It had become hopelessly corrupt. It says they only sought to do evil continually. Their minds invented evil things continually. That's all they could do. Their whole world was perverted in that sense. But Christ said, "For as in the days that were before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, and until the day that Noah entered into the ark, and they knew not, they couldn't see it coming until the flood came and took them all away. So shall also the coming of the Son of Man be." In the end time, he's saying, it's going to be just like it was back in Noah's day. People are going to be clueless as to what's happening. Totally clueless. In Luke 17:26, it says basically the same thing. I won't take the time to go there. Something else we ought to be aware of that certainly the world wouldn't care to acknowledge, but in Daniel 10, we see that there is a satanic element behind some of these world developments. Daniel 10, verse 13. This is an interesting passage, but it shows the struggle between great spirit beings that we may not be aware of. He says, "But the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days. But lo, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, and I remained there with the kings of Persia." Spirit powers are battling behind the scenes to affect the development of world affairs. And that certainly is true in our day. When we consider the terrorist element and the things that they have determined to do, We have to presume, just by the nature of what they're doing, we have to presume that there's a spirit power influencing what they're doing. God told his people to set watchmen. In Isaiah 21:6 and Ezekiel 33:2-7, he says, set watchmen who are going to keep abreast of what's going on and who are going to warn the people. Do we have those watchmen today? To the degree, at least, that we ought to. Then there's another group of people that are going to affect the world developments. Daniel 11:28, we were just there. And the prophet speaks of them at least four times. Daniel 11:28 and 30 and 32. And this is speaking to one of these great world powers in the end time. Then shall he return unto his land with great riches, and his heart shall be against the holy covenant. And he shall do exploits and return to his own land. The latter part of verse 30. He shall even return and have intelligence with them that forsake the holy covenant. Verse 32. And such as do wickedly against the covenant shall be he corrupt by flatteries. But the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits. Who are these people who forsake the holy covenant? That would be an interesting topic for another time. But they are people who are operating in the political sphere in this world. People of the covenant who have turned against that covenant and decided to support the powers in the world, the evil powers in the world at their time. We know we're going into a time called the time of Jacob's trouble. The people who are going in the nations in the world that are going to be in particularly difficult times are the peoples of Jacob. We know that. Hosea 7:11 tells us something about the nature of our own people. And these are people who have forsaken the standards upon which this country was founded. I know Hosea's in here. I just got to find it. It's right after Daniel. Hosea 7, verse 11. Ephraim also is like a silly dove without heart. They call to Egypt. They go to Assyria. Interesting, the prominent nations in the kings of the north and south, are they not? When they shall go, I will spread my net upon them. Verse 12. I will bring them down as fowls of the heaven. I will chastise them as their congregation has heard. What nations have heard, if not the peoples of Israel? Now, we've got something else developing on the scene. If anyone has noticed, it's called our national debt. What's the long-term outcome of that going to be? I think we know. I think we can see it coming. I think a lot of people can see it coming. But will we take the right actions to address the problem? They're not even talking about that in the debates. I suppose we could check the one tonight and see if it's a major topic. I'll bet it isn't. But what do you think is going to happen? Imagine life in this country as we live when there's no economy left, when we're down to bartering, when all of the dollars and all of the wealth that we have, nobody wants it. Nobody will accept it. What do we do? Very interesting passage of Scripture, and I should have spent more time with it, but let's turn to Ecclesiastes 10. I was looking at this. It just came up at the last minute for some reason. That always happens, I guess. But Ecclesiastes 10, and it's really the heart and essence of this message today. And it says so much. Ecclesiastes 10 starts out with a beautiful thought. Dead flies cause the ointment of the apothecary to send forth a stinking savor. Wonder why he said that. So does a little folly him that is in reputation for wisdom and honor. That may explain why people who are respected in their field for wisdom are not good at being comedians. But when we don't, exhibit the qualities of wisdom, it really creates, frankly, in the Bible's words, a stinking situation. Do we have that today? Verse 2, a wise man's heart is at his right hand, but a fool's heart at his left. Not literal, but it's a picture. It draws a contrast between the right and the left. Does God know about right brain, left brain issues? When someone is more right-brained than another, does his general worldview differ from those whose minds are dominated by left thinking? It's interesting that that same kind of terminology has brought itself right into our modern political scene. It's interesting how this is carried into even the modern era, right versus left. Yea, also when he that is a fool walks by the way, his wisdom fails him. And he says to everyone that he is a fool. People that are fools demonstrate it without even trying to. Some things are obvious even in ordinary situations. Those who try and explain their views, who aren't accepting of reality, find it hard to be coherent and logical, except perhaps to their like-thinking fellows. Verse 4, if the spirit of the ruler rise up against you, leave not your place. Don't compromise your principles. For yielding pacifies great offenses. Do you see any of that happening in our political world today? In other words, hold on to your principles, even against overbearing political pressures. Not reacting properly to a developing wrong never produces good results. But what happens when whole societies abandon their principles for less than good reasons? There is an evil, verse 5, there is an evil which I have seen under the sun as an error which proceeds from the ruler. Can we legitimately apply this in a religious situation, not just a political one? When error proceeds from the ruler. Verse 6, folly is set in great dignity, and the rich sit in low place. Role reversal. It's interesting how our culture is turned against those people who are accomplished. They've used their talents, they've used their skills. They've made a good situation for themselves. They've built businesses. They've employed many. In our society, the rich are perceived as evil personified. What's the thinking behind that? That's gained a lot of traction. The evil rich. Well, there might be some evil rich, but I think there's evil poor in a greater number, but that's another subject. Verse 6, folly is set in great dignity. Oh, I'm sorry, I just did that one. Verse 7, I have seen servants upon horses and princes walking as servants upon the earth. Role reversal. In other words, the poor are put in places to take advantage over those of real accomplishment. The servants become the benefactors of those who worked hard and made something of their lives. Those lower in accomplishment produce little more than resentment against them. Is that anything like we see today? Have we compromised our principles? Is that what's causing this? Let's go on to verse 8. He that digs a pit shall fall into it, and whoso breaks an hedge, a serpent shall bite him. Here's a good way of expressing the law of unintended consequences. Could you say it better? He that digs a pit shall fall into it, and whoever breaks a hedge, a serpent shall bite him. Didn't see it coming. Whoever removes stones shall be hurt therewith, and he that cleaves wood shall be endangered thereby. When you break down the establishment, that's the thing of taking down stones, whether they're boundary markers or whether they're walls. When you break down the establishment, it yields negative results. There's just so much resources to be spread around. And it ought to be spread on merit, not lack of action, lack of effort. How does our society see it? If the iron be blunt and he do not whet the edge, then he must put more strength into it. But wisdom is profitable to direct. Can you see the political undertones in all of this chapter? It's incredible. You're going to bash your way through, or you're going to sharpen your device and make a nice clean cut. You got to work harder to make a bad idea work. And it seems our government is hooked on that. Let's drop down to verse 12. The words of a wise man's mouth are gracious, but the lips of a fool will swallow up himself. This is called being entrapped by your own utterances. Are our politicians doing that today? Verse 14, a fool also is full of words. A man cannot tell what shall be and what shall be after him. Who can tell him? There's very few among us who are wise enough to realize the long-term consequences of our decisions and our actions. Verse 15, the labor of the foolish wearies every one of them because he knows not how to go to the city. He's lost his basic orientation. He can't even find his own way home. He's that far out of it. What an amazing chapter. I never saw that in this way before. But when you look at today's political climate, not just national, but world political climate, what words of wisdom are those? We should ponder those. In Daniel 12, verse 10, there's a very profound statement. And it's one that I hope will give us a hope that makes all the difference, because things are going to get tough. Things are going to take off in directions we never fully expected. But when they happen, God says, verse 10, many shall be purified and made white and tried. And as we can know from the context, this is talking about the end time specifically. And it says, but the wicked shall do wickedly, and none of the wicked shall understand, but the wise shall understand. God is going to give understanding to the wise. And as we saw, the wise are not the intelligent necessarily. For the most part, it has nothing to do with intelligence. It has to do with obeying God, learning about God, understanding His ways, and following His commands. Those are the wise. We're not going to gain understanding necessarily by our intelligent analyses. God's Spirit is going to work with those who are His, and He's going to give them the ability to understand. The wise will understand, but none of the wicked will understand. That's a very profound thought, but I think it gives us assurance, because as this world gets crazier by the moment, by the minute, the wise are going to see it coming. Let's seek that wisdom.